Hi, I'm Brian McCreath, and this is the Answered Question from WCRB in Boston for November 24th, 2017. A bit of Copland for your Thanksgiving weekend, in this case from the Chameleon Arts Ensemble. This performance of Appalachian Spring is part of what you'll hear on Sunday at 7 p.m. on WCRB in Concert. It's a program that also includes Copland's 12 poems of Emily Dickinson, a piano quintet by Amy Beach, and a quartet for winds by Arthur Berger. And you'll hear about all of it on this podcast with the founder, artistic director, and flutist of Chameleon Arts Ensemble, Deborah Bolden. Also on the podcast this week are pianist Rudolf Buchbinder, the soloist you'll hear in Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 1 on our live Boston Symphony Orchestra broadcast on Saturday night, and BSO music director Andres Nelsons, who conducts the Beethoven as well as Bruckner's Fourth Symphony. Again, that broadcast is on Saturday. It begins at 8 p.m. So there's a lot to get to, starting with the Chameleon Arts Ensemble. Their 20th anniversary season began with an all-American program that included Appalachian Spring by Copland. So I asked Deb Bolden if, in the process of putting the program together, she came to think of the idea of an American sound any differently from how she had before.
I would say, actually, that it's impossible to capture what an American sound is in any one concert program or through any one voice. And I wasn't necessarily trying to figure out what the American sound is, except through the lens of Aaron Copland, because what he did very deliberately in the 30s was to try, at the suggestion of his teacher, the great Nadia Boulanger, was to create a sense of what an American sound is separate from the European tradition. So this particular program, which we called Create an American Sound, just as sort of an umbrella idea for it, was really through that lens. What did Copland do? And we included works by other composers like Arthur Berger, who were influenced by Copland, and also Amy Beach on the flip side of things, who was very influenced or came directly out of the European tradition, so that we could get a sense of where Copland started and where he was going.
Oh, that's brilliant. That's fantastic. I mean, you've said before in interviews you've done here with us and with the newspapers that you like for programs to follow a thread, sort of have a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Yes.
And that's actually, that's literally what you're describing, a beginning with Beach, a middle with Copland, and a continuation with Berger. I might kind of put it in those categories. And so what then do each of those composers tell you about America? What does Beach say about America at the time she was writing?
Well, she really came out of the late Romantic traditions. She was influenced by Brahms, the piano quintet that we performed very much in particular. I believe that she took some of the ideas from the last movement of Brahms' very famous piano quintet and, you know, molded them in her own way to create something that was part of the great classical music tradition. Copland himself wanted to take a turn from that. But of course, I strongly believe that without the tradition behind us, you know, we can't really continue the path forward, whether you decide you're going to take a left turn or continue along where you've already heard or where you've already been. And Arthur Berger and composers today continue that. And really, what is American music at this point? It's anything that has been composed in any style, with any texture, by anybody who happens to be here at any given time. So the idea of American is so vast, and we're just really just started to look at one tiny portion of it.
Yeah, it's just definitely scratching the surface. So let's start with Copland and Appalachian Spring. I guess you know, it's a piece that so many people are familiar with it in some degree, even if they've never heard an orchestral concert with that piece. They still have encountered it in so many other places through other media, that the orchestral version is something that feels really ingrained in a lot of people's consciousness. What does the version you did, the original 13-instrument chamber version, what is the experience like of that piece, do you think, for a listener compared to that orchestral version? Does the original version highlight aspects of Appalachian Spring that kind of get a little maybe lost in the orchestral version?
Well, I think both versions are absolutely wonderful, and they really get at the heart of what Copland was trying to do, which is to take his earlier explorations in creating an American sound with works from the 30s like Rodeo, Billy the Kid, etc., and take it kind of almost up a level. And what he does is, I think the reason that this piece is so enduring is because not only does it follow this sort of Americana that's new and very recognizable, wide open sounds, open textures. You can see in your mind almost the vast landscape, you know, out west or anywhere, actually. You just go in your backyard and you look across a lawn and there you have it, the sight. And what he did also, though, with Appalachian Spring was capture a feeling of hope and of possibility. And that is something which I think is really uniquely American and something that you can't define with, you know, discussing how the piece is constructed. And I think that you get that sense of openness, almost vulnerability, possibility more directly in the 13-player version than you do in the orchestral version, which is just a larger mass of sound that comes around you as a listener. And in this way, it's very direct. It's almost one person speaking to another.
Yeah, no, that's the effect, I think, that when you have these individual voices combining rather than entire string sections combining, there is something that's a more intimate quality about the piece itself. There's more of a, you feel like you're connecting to individual people, maybe even a little bit more.
You're having a conversation both with the players and with the composer, I think.
Right. And in many ways, that's the definition of chamber music. To me, well, as a trumpet player, I always found Appalachian Spring in the orchestra to already be a much more difficult piece than people even really realize that it is. I mean, it's a difficult rhythmic setup in the piece and transitions. I can't really kind of wrap my head around what the challenges are for 13 players without a conductor to do it. Did you find Appalachian Spring for 13 players to be especially challenging as a chamber musician?
Well, you have to approach a situation like that where you know everyone else's parts, and you also have to really trust your colleagues. So, yes, I would say it's a difficult piece. It's challenging. There are challenging aspects to it. But the excitement of putting it together and feeling a room full of 13 people with a single common goal is really thrilling. And without having a conductor to be the traffic cop, everyone is sort of more joined together in that experience, I think. And so, yes, difficult. And the things that are difficult about Copland are these irregular or slightly jagged rhythms and the very, very open textures. And both of these things in real time sound organic and just as it comes, it seems like it should be quite simple, right? And in fact, all of that, that quote-unquote simplicity is quite challenging to execute.
Totally. And there is that way when, if there is a conductor involved, it almost, in my experience, it can actually ratchet down an individual player's sense of contribution because they're relying on the conductor maybe a little bit more than they need to. And when that conductor is removed, everybody's concentration and involvement with each other's parts ratchets up because they know that there's not really the safety net, if you will, of a conductor. It sort of like gets into this higher level of involvement.
I think in an in-the-moment individual level, although I think that orchestral players would probably say, well, no, we're very, very involved, and I know that they are, and
yeah,
I've played in orchestras as well. But it is, you're getting on a kind of a bigger train with an orchestra, and you know, as far as safety nets go, you know, if one string player out of 20 has a issue, you know, it's easily ignored. But one out of four, you probably hear it.
Well, and certainly you're right. Not to take anything away from orchestral players, there's a very high degree of concentration going on in those settings.
Indeed.
As well. But so then there's the 12 poems of Emily Dickinson. And it was written only over a series of years. It was put together only a few years after Appalachian Spring.
Right.
And do you hear a different Copland in that set of songs from what we hear in Appalachian Spring?
Well, I hear an evolution of Copland. And I think that where he's heading is more toward the piano quartet. Or he experimented in a lot of different styles and moving toward a more serial style. And for your listeners, this would come sort of out of the Schoenberg tradition. But still, it still has a Copland-esque quality. There still are the wide-ranging sounds, open sounds, and still irregular rhythms, which actually, in terms of working together with Emily Dickinson's poems, is a perfectly natural fit. On the one hand, we're taking one of America's greatest composers, merging with one of America's greatest poets, who's both their rhythmic languages are surprisingly compatible. And they both sound, I think, or they both are so distinctive in their own styles and yet kind of in a parallel world as well.
Right.
So Copland still sounds like Copland. Dickinson still sounds like Dickinson when they come together.
And at the same time, one of the things that you mentioned about Appalachian Spring is that what Copland was doing was partly capturing an almost unique sense of hope embedded in America, in the consciousness of this country.
Yes.
And that's not really what people think of at first with Emily Dickinson. Hope isn't the first thing that rises to your mind, I think, in her poetry. So it's, in some ways, there's a challenge for Copland to take that approach into poetry that can at times seem more like resignation or I don't know. You're so tuned into poetry. Do you feel like sometimes there's an interesting part of Copland's voice that comes through Emily Dickinson's poetry?
Well, he was very interested in trying to get to her essence when he was working on these pieces. He actually went to her house in Amherst and tried to soak up the surroundings and really capture her essence. And what he did, I think, was capture more of his own essence, which is, as I mentioned, in parallel with Emily Dickinson. And the thing that I think is so remarkable about his settings is that he was able to capture the vulnerability of Emily Dickinson. And the texts that he chose combined both the ordinary, maybe changing seasons, knocks on the door, listening to a bugle, with the extraordinary aspects of her poetry and her preoccupations with eternity and death. And in doing so, I think he came around to his own vulnerability and fragility in that music.
When did you first encounter even the figure, the historical figure of Amy Beach and her music in general?
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, we've actually played Amy Beach's piano quintet one time before. And, you know, in the old days, I used to be able to say the date and time and place of every piece that we've performed. But
20 years is a lot.
Yeah, we've you know, there have been too many concerts for me to be able to do that. But I think it was in maybe it was 2001 or 2002, something like that. And I actually cannot remember the first time I encountered her music. She has a wonderful piano trio, and flutists actually play her violin sonata from time to time. It translates more or less well, I think.
Yeah,
and, you know, I'm very interested in composers that have been neglected. And so on every single Chameleon program, there's something, you know, a great war horse, something we all know and love. And then something from an older work, you know, a dead composer, that we just don't hear anymore. So, you know, Amy Beach has been on our series a few times, and we do composers like Korngold that people don't hear, or Leo Orenstein, and just a number of other, you know, from that late Romantic tradition in particular, I think, where there were so many people writing so much great music, and they get missed because we focus a lot on Brahms and Schumann, and rightly so. That's amazing music. But
what was it about the piano quintet among the choices that you would have of Amy Beach's music to include in this program? What was it about the piano quintet that made you want to draw that in?
Oh gosh, well I choose just basically on a kind of a visceral, emotional level. And to be honest, I wasn't choosing between Amy Beach's works. If I can pull back the curtain a little bit, I was choosing between Amy Beach's piano quintet and two works by Arthur Foote, who also late Romantic, very, you know, neglected, I would say, American composer. And I was picking between he has a piano quintet and a piano quartet. And I had thought I'd settled on the piano quartet. And then I thought, well, I'll take another listen to her piano quintet. And in the end, I just decided that for my own taste, that hers was the superior work.
And so your choice didn't actually have anything to do with the fact that it's an Amy Beach anniversary year.
That was completely by accident.
Oh, my gosh,
and,
no kidding.
Yeah.
I kind of assumed that we were sort of headed in that way because it's a good time to talk about Amy Beach, right?
Apparently so. I was completely unaware of this, and okay. it was just good fortune. And as I have found over the years, that these little alignments, either in music history or themes that emerge accidentally out of chameleon programs, have been the most exciting for me. And I think it just highlights the interconnectedness in the world. You know, music is, everything is intertwined. We're all connected to each other. And if you look long enough, you can find them.
Do you feel like there's more of Amy Beach for chameleon to explore in the future?
Sure. I can't imagine. I never close myself off to any
possibility. I know
possibility.
You have like files of programs just waiting to be done. And I just wonder if Amy Beach factors into some of that.
Well, she has some wonderful songs that I might like to do. And we haven't actually done the Violin Sonata, so that's on my list as well.
Yeah. So the Berger, the Quartet for Winds by Arthur Berger, I wonder if this is one of those pieces that wind players specifically know backwards and forwards and even talk about, but kind of the rest of us, it's almost like the rest of us don't really know it that well. And maybe it should be played more often. I don't know. Is it that kind of a piece to you?
Well, I think it is. And I'm not certain that I would venture a guess that actually Arthur Berger himself is just not that well known. You know, those American composers who were writing around the time of Copland rather overshadowed, although that's an unfair statement. Copland did a great deal to promote music of his friends and colleagues and the wonderful American composers of the time, including Arthur Berger. But we don't hear this music today. I'm thinking also of Roy Harris,
Roger Sessions,
Walter Piston, you know, all this whole group. But Copland has, you know, after we, as you can always, what is the adage? Hindsight is 20/20. You look back and Copland's works kind of loom large, right? And part of it is because of the hope and possibility that is infused in his music. But yes, woodwind players all know Arthur Berger's quartet because it's one of the best examples of composition for this configuration of flute, oboe, clarinet, and bassoon.
And as a piece that was dedicated to Copland, it's almost like the poster child for how to dedicate a piece but not sound exactly like the composer to whom you're dedicating, you know, because it doesn't sound like Copland really, but you feel the essence, you feel that the presence of Copland in Berger's world.
Yes.
When you hear this music. And I love the piece. I think it's just terrific. I mean, I guess I see what you're saying, that Berger maybe just could use a lot more attention in general, not just for this piece of music. I mean, his music is so well crafted and so beautiful in so many ways. But maybe the quartet is one of the friendlier pieces, or to use the sort of easy term, more accessible pieces.
It is, but not from a performer's perspective. It's quite difficult to put together. The counterpoint is very, very dense, and also he uses similar open textures that Copland does, which are also very difficult to execute. And but it's one of those pieces that once you've spent the time on it, you can put it in, mark the checkbox. Yes, this was absolutely worth it, and I'm a more well-rounded artist for having gone through the process of learning and playing this piece. I thought it was really exciting to perform.
Was this the first Chameleon program for the Berger Quartet?
We did an auxiliary concert about 15 years ago with it, but yes, this is the first Chameleon series concert with that piece. Yeah,
I love that you included it. I mean, I think that it's such a it comes from, as you say, that time when there were so many other incredible composers working alongside Copland, and it's a nice representative of that time and all the energy that was flowing through the musical culture of the mid-20th century, and the ways that Copland both influenced that and the ways that people wanted to move away, you know, for their own voice to come through. And so I love that it's part of this program.
Well, thank you. And I chose it very deliberate because of Berger's connections with Copland. They were both members of the Young Composers, was it club or association at the time, and Berger wrote a very important book on Copland in, I think it was 1953-ish or so, and there was a very important essay that he did on Copland's piano variations, which also kind of joined the two forever.
Yeah. Well, and boy, talk about it. Dynamite piece of music, but also the kind of thing that you'd actually wouldn't have expected Copland to write before you hear it.
The variations.
It's time bomb. So the Chameleon's 20th anniversary season, it is like so many seasons of Chameleon, just shot through with all kinds of variety and unexpected pairings, combinations, textural variety. I mean, I love seeing your seasons, but I just wonder if for this season, was there anything different that you did in approaching how you would put the overall arc of the season together?
Well, one of the things that I wanted to do was kind of infuse a sense of nostalgia into it. And how I approached that was by including at least one piece on every concert that we've performed before, somewhere in the past 20 years, but with a new or fresh perspective, so presented in a different way. So on our first concert, it was Amy Beach's piano quintet, which is a funny and I think kind of, you know, if you're going to pick a piece to repeat, you know, that's a kind of unexpected one. But
right.
It's such a great work. Why not? And it fit perfectly within that, the ethos of that opening concert.
Yeah.
But so I wanted that sense of nostalgia to be threaded throughout the year and yet still have each program itself feel like a distinct experience. One of the things which always concerns me when I'm putting together programs and when I'm choosing which programs will go across a season is, am I repeating myself? You know, because I do have a little bit of a formula. I hate that word, but a formula that I use in order to construct a program. So it has to have something from the classic standard literature, usually some kind of, you know, super beloved war horse type thing. It has to have neglected composers that are no longer with us that we don't hear. It has to have something contemporary. Sometimes one, sometimes two pieces. And it has to have a variety of instruments, too. So I have for myself a formula of how many times we might have clarinet across the year, how many times we might have, flute or oboe. And just imposing those structures on myself forces me to come up with a variety of sounds for each program, and then I hope each program itself kind of lives in its own world and yet is still connected to the chameleon continuum anyways.
Yeah, yeah. No, and that's the thing that I mean, you know, this gets kind of philosophical, but I do think that creativity often can be sparked by something like limits or by formula. You know, there are ways that it actually forces you into some decisions that are good, that are really illuminate the kinds of variety you're talking about when you're dealing with some degree of formula. So I totally get what you're talking about.
It makes you think outside of the box in a way.
Yeah, yeah. The space where you guys perform at First Church is such an interesting building just in general. But experiencing a concert there, I mean, I don't know how many. Have you performed there from the very start?
Yes, our first concert in October of 98 was at First Church.
And was it chosen? Was that space chosen out of convenience, or did you scout a lot of potential spaces for Chameleon to take hold and just find this one to be like, yes, this is really the kind of space we want? I mean, I guess I'm setting this all up because the context is to me, it's such a great space for what you do, because there's a it's not a huge space. And so it's a chamber music space where you can feel very involved as an audience member. You don't feel a strong sense of separation from the performers.
And well, that's very important, right? With any kind of small ensemble, right? You want to feel like you can almost, that sweat from the musicians might flick across to you.
But I mean, but even visually, the way that the architecture works within that space, there's a sort of funneling of vision towards the performers, I find, when I sit in that space. And so I guess, I just wonder, like, how the space has helped to shape Chameleon.
Well, I think that early on we recognized the need to be in a fairly small space that, although I love going to chamber music concerts at Jordan Hall, and I love Jordan Hall, and I played there many times myself, that a 1,000-seat hall wasn't going to produce the kind of intimacy that I was after. Also, from a very practical standpoint, we perform quite an eclectic array of old and new music, and in realistic and practical terms, we were not going to fill up 1,000 people to listen to these concerts. And I don't know that that would necessarily serve the repertoire in the same way anyways. Mm-hmm. So we wanted something in the city of Boston. And so we did look at a number of spaces, but they have a great piano. They have, you know, it is, we can seat on the floor at First Church 170 or 190 people, and that seems to me to be a really great number to listen to the type of chamber music that we're presenting. And over the course of 20 years, I have to say that we're very, very grateful to the folks at First Church in Boston, and we have really become, we feel a part of their community in a way that I would never have anticipated 20 years ago when we first started presenting concerts there. When we go to set up for a performance, we're coming home in a way. And they treat us like that, and we try to do so in kind for them. So it's a wonderful kind of joining.
Yeah, yeah. Do you feel like there's anything, I mean, Chameleon has grown from just a handful of concerts in its first season to now, I think what I read was that there are 19 separate, distinct events through the course of your season. Is that about right?
19 concerts this year.
Yeah, 19 concerts. I just wonder what your vision is for the next 20 years. I
mean,
is there something that do you, or, I mean, it's fine to say like, we're doing just what we want to do and we're going to continue kind of this thing that we love as Chameleon Arts Ensemble, or is there sort of another stage or development of Chameleon that you toy with in your mind that you would like to sort of pursue?
Gosh, that's a really difficult question because if you had asked me that 20 years ago, I think I would be able to come up with a grander statement because you don't know what you don't know.
You don't know what you're getting into.
Right.
Yeah,
Although when I originally started the group, and this dream still does live with me, it was I was inspired by this wonderful series in Brooklyn called Barge Music, where they have concerts every week of the year. And I still have this little inkling of a dream that why couldn't chamber music concerts be every weekend? And you have musicians on salary the same way you do for a symphony orchestra, and it's just all the time. That might be slightly too grand, but why not continue to hold on to those dreams? So for me, I think that we are performing the kind of music that I envisioned 20 years ago. We continue to do that. And I always love to do more concerts. So if the opportunity presents itself, we'll certainly be heading in that direction. And it might be nice also to try to take some of these programs on the road if they're the ones that are smaller and more mobile.
Some touring.
Sure. I mean, if anyone would like to have us, we're available.
I think that's a great idea to spread Chameleon wider beyond First Church and beyond Boston and get more people to hear the kind of programming and the kind of artistry that you guys bring to it. So I love the idea. I hope that can work out.
Thank you. We too.
Deborah Bolden, thanks for coming to the station today.
Thanks for having me.
Deborah Bolden is the founder and artistic director of Chameleon Arts Ensemble, and you can hear them on Sunday night on WCRB in concert beginning at 7 p.m. And by the way, did you notice the flute in the background? Well, even though Deb is a flutist, it was just a complete coincidence that another flutist happened to be practicing in the next room where we did the interview. Anyway, be sure to check out the Chameleon's upcoming concerts. On the weekend of December 1st and 2nd, they'll perform a program that includes music by Haydn, Debussy, and David Ludwig, along with Olivier Messiaen's Quartet for the End of Time. They're at chameleonarts.org, and you'll also find a link at the In Concert page of our website, classicalwcrb.org. The guest soloist in this week's Boston Symphony Orchestra program is pianist Rudolf Buchbinder, who plays Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 1. Buchbinder is from the generation of musicians born right after World War II, and he's known for, among other things, a voracious appetite for collecting scores, manuscripts, and first editions of music. So when I met him at Symphony Hall this week, I asked him why learning works by Beethoven is so important through those first editions.
Oh, I'm not only collecting first editions of Beethoven, also of Brahms. I have complete Schönberg first editions from all his piano works, Alban Berg, and of course Brahms, Schubert, and of course Beethoven. Beethoven is fascinating for me. For my whole life, I live with him as a composer and as a human being, you know. But, you know, the problem is that especially in the first editions, if Beethoven didn't control it, he controlled a lot. But many first editions are the biggest mistakes.
Oh, in the first edition, there are big mistakes.
In the first edition. And they are copied from the next editions and the next editions. For instance, especially finally now with the Fifth Concerto by Beethoven, there are two tremendous mistakes from the first edition. And thanks to the autograph, we know now today what Beethoven wrote. That he wrote the last bars from the second movement. There's one bar which the orchestra always played pizzicato, but it is Argo. And it was in all, this mistake was in the first edition. It was not controlled by Beethoven. You know, we make the difference. The first edition is the Erstausgabe, and then exists the Originalausgabe. The Originalausgabe was controlled by Beethoven, the Erstausgabe not.
Okay, I see. And so when it comes to the Piano Concerto No. 1,
yes,
the second one he wrote,
yes,
are there similar disparity between the first edition and the manuscript?
Not so many. I don't know the manuscript. I have the first edition, by the way. I have the first edition of the score, of the orchestra score, of the piano solo score. There are no mistakes. I controlled it. No, it's the way I play it today and how the editions are. Fascinating is also Beethoven wrote three cadenzas for the first movement. People know only two, the second and the third, but the first is far the best cadenza. Unfortunately, it's unfinished.
Have you ever tried to finish it for him? Or
yes, I finished this first cadenza, but with bars, original bars by Beethoven from the second and the third cadenza. They fit perfectly. So actually, everything is original Beethoven, but it's a kind of a potpourri, a mixture, a highlight of the cadenzas.
And this is what you play?
Yes, this is what I play, yes.
And what, besides that, what else makes the Piano Concerto No. 1 so distinctive, and what attracts you to it, particularly compared to the other four more commonly played, especially 3, 4, and 5, played.
But you know, the number, when I played the five piano concerti in the cycle, I played mostly in two nights, the most difficult is number 2.
Oh.
Also, when I conduct it from the piano, number 2 is very difficult, and the first movement of number 4. Number 5 is the easiest concerto.
Okay.
Yes, it's just popular, but it's the easiest concerto because everybody knows it. Number 1 is a real treasure. And, you know, when people say it's influenced the first symphonies or piano concerto by Mozart, you know, I spoke with Wolfgang Sawallisch or with Nicolas Anoncourt, they drive themselves furious about this. He says it has nothing to do with Mozart, nothing, absolutely nothing. That's Beethoven and nothing else, and that's true. Has nothing to do with Mozart. Or,
and yet it is.
And by the way, Beethoven hated Mozart, so why should he be influenced?
Okay. But it is, I guess maybe people are misunderstand that because it is a more classically oriented Beethoven than the later concertos.
You know,
is that correct? No?
There are very few pieces with such a humor like in the C major concerto by Beethoven. And one more thing, in each concerto by Beethoven, by all five, there are always some bars of a real swing.
Swing?
Swing. In the third movements, for instance. And these few bars are continuously in all five concerti.
Wow, something to look for, something really to listen for.
But Mozart, Beethoven, all these guys, Schubert, they have been the pop artists at that time. You know, the first movement of Moonlight Sonata, everybody played it. And Beethoven was so upset about that. He always said, I've written so much better works in my life. Why everybody plays this stupid slow movement?
I have to ask you about performing with this orchestra. I watched you in a rehearsal yesterday, and I just have to, say, I don't know that I've ever seen a soloist listen so intently to the introduction of any concerto as you were yesterday, as you listened to Andras and the BSO give the introduction for the concerto. What were you listening for? What do you want to hear from an orchestra before you start playing in this piece?
What I want to hear? Everything. Everything. You know, I know all concerti I play by heart. I know each score of each instrument, even the second oboe. If they miss it, then I play it on the piano immediately. or sometimes a whistle. I did it once in Milano in the orchestra, the first Brahms concerto. I was whistling on stage. You know, I grew up with chamber music, and it's very important to learn to listen to the others. And I'm very sad about some colleagues that only know their part, the piano part, and nothing else. For instance, when my students play the Mozart piano concerto. From half of the concerti, we have the original cadenza by Mozart. You have to play, except Köchel 466, the cadenza by Beethoven. Of course, this is a fantastic composition. But the other half, Mozart didn't write any cadenzas. So I play my own cadenzas, but I never allowed my students to play my cadenzas. I said to them, you have to write a cadenza. And I said, just look at the introduction from the movement. You hear everything, you can see everything what is going on in this movement. Try to make a cadenza out of it. They're the same when I say to my students, before you play anything by Rachmaninoff, Gershwin, or Ravel, or Beethoven, first read a book about the person. And then I allow you to play a piece by him.
Oh, so it's really important for you to know that person before you really get into the music.
Of course, that's very important. to know the time, what is going on, and so on.
Rudolf Buchbinder, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Rudolf Buchbinder is the soloist in Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 1 in WCRB's live broadcast of the Boston Symphony Orchestra this Saturday at 8 p.m. And the conductor of that concert is Andras Nelsons, the BSO's music director. Along with the Beethoven, he and the orchestra will perform Bruckner's Fourth Symphony, the Romantic Symphony. When I talked with Andras at the hall this week, he told me about what it's like to work with Rudolf Buchbinder.
I have played several times with him, Mozart, Beethoven, and Brahms. And it's always great pleasure because it is making music at the moment, you know. And of course, he has absolute understanding of style and of time and of articulation and so on. But the most important is that he makes music on. It's a feeling that he composes when, like Beethoven did very often when he played, he very often just almost composed and played at the same time. So this is a great feeling. And also he listens to the orchestra and he passes his themes to the orchestra and then he integrates. So he sometimes plays without conductor. So he's a real musician, real soloist and real chamber musician and a really wonderful personality, and it's always great pleasure, you know. So it shows that the age is a relative thing, he's very, very youthful in his spirits and in his way of playing.
I noticed just watching rehearsal a few minutes ago that he was, I mean, I know every soloist listens to the orchestra, but he seemed to be listening to the orchestra very intently. He really wanted something from the orchestra, yeah. Very specifically, it seemed.
Exactly. He, of course, knows all these pieces so well, and he's looking for some color or some dynamic or some character, but the way he watches, he looks, and looking to him, it's clear what he wants. And the body language and the understanding without words, that's actually a real thing, because the music, of course, we can talk a lot about music and it's important to talk about music, but when making music together, sometimes you can talk and still not to be in a different tracks, you know. And sometimes it's just you play and you just understand each other without talking. And that's the case with Buchbinder, Rudy Buchbinder is always great fun.
The Bruckner Fourth Symphony, we've talked about Bruckner with a couple of the other symphonies before, but this is the most popular one. This is the one that gets played by most. If an orchestra is going to play Bruckner, they're going to play the Fourth. And I wonder, from your perspective, why that is. What is it about the Fourth that makes it the one that most people seem to be able to relate to, the one that most people seem to be able to grab onto something and really understand?
Well, maybe from the Fourth Symphony on, and particularly the Fourth itself, firstly, it was relatively successful in his lifetime when it was performed, because the Third was a disaster, you know, half of the audience more left and so on. But Four maybe is the most romantic in its very romantic approach, also as a genre romantic. So this maybe applies to more people and they understand it more, because there are beautiful melodies. Second movement, there are scherzo, which is like a hunt. You visually can imagine that the hunters, and then the trio is like a rest in between when they eat food and relax. And so you can almost visualize. But for me, I don't know. I always look to Bruckner as a, from both from two aspects mostly. It is, of course, Bruckner and religion, which is very, very strong aspect, of course. But parallelly, Bruckner, human being, he had his lot of doubts about music, doubts about composing, doubts about life, doubts about many, many things. What, you know, he was really a very interesting personality, very, very strange personality, and very still are many, many questions regarding Bruckner. So if we say that we probably think that we know how Mahler was, and, you know, the many books and letters and even maybe other composers, that with Bruckner is not so. I think it's so many questions still with Bruckner, and I'm very, very curious, and I think also with now going through his music, also recording his symphonies in Leipzig, we do. It's very interesting to be, to read and to try to get deeper into his world, which is very, very special, very naive, but very rich at the same time. And you really feel that the composer is not complaining about himself. He's not writing about his life so much. It's not egoistic, this music. When you listen to this music, and you, of course, sometimes it's long, you are waiting, you have to be patient, but then comes the culminations, and then at the end, the codas, you feel lifted, and you feel lifted not because of Bruckner, let's say, but you feel lifted as a, I don't know, the Holy Spirit or the whatever spirit or the Buddha or or what, it depends what you believe in. So I'm very happy to share our passion with Bruckner music to the audience, because there is not a long tradition of Bruckner here in Boston. So we want to bring every season one symphony so the audience could get used to, you know, and to this composer.
And I'm so glad that you brought up that idea of you don't feel when you hear it like it's Bruckner's experience you're listening to. Among the many things that are great about the BSO, one of them is the program books that Mark Mandel and Robert Kurzinger put together. They're amazing notes and essays that they put together, and Mark had something in the program book for this week that is kind of exactly what you said, that Mahler's symphonies are self-psychoanalysis. Mm-hmm. We're always thinking about what's going on in Mahler. Mm-hmm. Bruckner's symphonies are more like liturgical acts.
Yes.
They're more like not worship, but they're more like something that is meant to take you somewhere else. They're not about a personal insight.
Yes, yeah, he's not complaining.
Although
he couldn't, he was so insecure, and he has so many questions, much more questions, I think, than Mahler, maybe. But he wants to that we would take the journey. He's not forcing us to take the journey, but because of that he's not forcing, we want to take the journey. And
this music spoke to you very early on.
Yeah.
This was one of the composers you got onto very early in your life.
I think it's interesting. First was, well, I mean, really first was a Renaissance and Baroque music when I was like a year too old, and folk music of Latvian, but, you know, folk songs and so. But really from the first seriously was Wagner when I was five, and then very closely came Bruckner. And I just wanted to listen to Bruckner symphonies. I found it. Also, maybe it was, I found that there is a link to Wagner and there is something similar, but in the meantime, very different as well. So I like to listen to long when I was a kid, you know, six, seven. I just switched off the light. We had LPs at that time, of course, and close my eyes and sit and just listen to the symphonies and long and. It was like an act, you know, of joy, and that's how I listened to music when I was a, you know, kid. And then later, of course, I went to concerts as well. But I somehow remember this special event. I switched off the lights, then I LP, you know, little that, and I found and I like to quite loud, you know, I put a loudspeaker as well. So and I don't know, the music, it immediately took me away. I don't know. It's maybe because I also am a shy person, and I somehow feels very. I in a way maybe share some of his subconsciously some of his questions and some of his thoughts. But you know, in the force, this also thing is that if with Mahler, who is of course a genius composer, but you have in each symphony many moments which you can say, well, that's fantastic moment. That's a fantastic moment. You can't say what really is the culmination, which really is your favorite. You think, well, in each moment there is this. But with Bruckner, there are not so many. But in the meantime, when those things come, those few moments of extreme it's not a beauty. It's just you feel like the heaven is opening.
That's Andres Nelsons, the music director of the Boston Symphony, and he'll lead the orchestra in Bruckner's Fourth Symphony in WCRB's Saturday night broadcast, live at 8 p.m. You can subscribe to The Answered Question at Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app, and TAQ is also on SoundCloud and at the website classicalwcrb.org. Thank you to Deborah Bolden, Rudolf Buchbinder, and Andres Nelsons, as well as the staff of the Boston Symphony for helping to make these conversations possible. I'm Brian McCreath. Thanks for listening.